We've used most animals like tools and products, and some of them have been our companions. And my prediction for the future is that we're going to do the exact same thing with robots and AI, that most of them will be tools and products, and some of them will be companions.
You're listening to the ISF podcast for your organization's better cybersecurity. Your host, ISF CEO Steve Durbin, is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today, Steve is in conversation with Dr. Kate Darling, research scientist at the MIT Media Lab and research lead at the Boston Dynamics AI Institute. Kate has spent years studying human-robot interaction, and she speaks with Steve about the fascinating impact such interactions can have on us as people, and what that means for businesses trying to incorporate robots and AI into their customer experience.
Kate, lovely to see you. Thanks so much for stopping by the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you're a bit of an expert in robotics and society. You're at MIT. And you've really investigated social robotics and conducted experimental studies on human-robot interaction, which I'm really fascinated to hear a bit more about, because what you've been trying to do, if I understand it correctly, is explore the emotional connection between people and machines. Is that right?
That is absolutely right, yeah.
So tell us a little bit about that. What does that all mean? What's it all about?
The way I got into this was I bought a robot toy back in 2007.
Right.
And it was this very cute baby dinosaur robot that had all this complex technology inside of it, motors, touch sensors, an infrared camera, it had a tilt sensor. But the thing that really made it special was it was able to mimic lifelike behavior really well, including things like pain and distress. So if you held it up by the tail, it would squirm and it would cry. And I found myself really feeling for it. So when someone would hold it up too long and it would, like, quote unquote, struggle, it started to bother me. Mm-hmm. And that sparked this curiosity in me. Why was I treating this thing like it was alive, even though I knew it was just a machine? Was it just me? I was observing other people do this with my toy as well. And so that's how I found myself in this really weird research world of human-robot interaction and looking at the psychology of how and why we treat automated technologies like they're alive, despite all knowledge to the contrary. And it turns out this is something that we do very automatically and easily. And then I started thinking about what that means in a world where we are increasingly integrating robotic technology that mm-hmm. does move in an autonomous way and kind of tricks our brains into projecting intent onto the movement. So that is the world that I've been in.
So that's how it all started. I'm intrigued. Why do we treat robots in that way? Why is there that sort of emotional connection?
Well, there's a few reasons, but I think the two most important ones are that we tend to anthropomorphize anything. So we project human-like traits, qualities, emotions, behaviors onto non-humans. We love to do this with animals, for example, mm-hmm. project emotions that may or may not be there. It's very ingrained in us. So like even an infant, the first thing an infant learns to recognize is a face, mm-hmm. and it doesn't even have to be a real face. So that's one tendency that we have. And then another thing that our brains respond really strongly to is movement. So right. we're constantly scanning our environments and trying to separate things into objects and agents. And that makes sense evolutionarily because we've had to watch out for agents in the past. But what it means now, as we have robots increasingly coming into shared spaces, is that any kind of autonomous movement will trick our brains into thinking it's an agent. Mm-hmm. And then we will automatically, kind of subconsciously, treat it like it's alive. So you see this happen even with the most simple robots, like the Roomba vacuum cleaner.
Right, yep.
And people will name their Roomba just because it's moving around on its own. They don't name their other vacuum cleaners. Mm-hmm. And as we have more and more complex design of robotics as well, so beyond just a disc that moves around and more biologically inspired technology, that really gets people to kind of treat it like it's alive. And in social robotics, which tries to harness this intentionally and tries to intentionally get people to treat robots like social agents, you'll see people even develop emotional connections to robots.
And I read somewhere, I think I may have seen on YouTube, one of the things you were talking about was even taking an army situation where they're using robots to, you know, go hunting for mines and IEDs and all of that kind of stuff, that even commanding officers have formed some of this relationship with these robots and get quite upset if they get blown up, which...
Oh, yeah. There's been research done on this as well, but we've known this for close to 15 years now, that the bomb disposal units that have been deployed in the U.S. military, the soldiers will become really emotionally attached to them. They've given them names and medals of honor. They've had funerals with gun salutes for them when they can't be repaired anymore. And I actually used to believe that this was something that we should prevent because, mm-hmm. you know, if you're creating a robot that's supposed to be your friend, yes, you want people to anthropomorphize and treat it like it's right. an agent. But if you're creating a robot that's meant to be a tool, it can be anything from inefficient to dangerous to have people becoming emotionally attached to it. There's even an example in Peter Singer's book, Wired for War, of a soldier rushing onto a battlefield to, quote unquote, save a robot. And so that's obviously not a great situation because we want robots to be protecting people, not putting them in harm's way. But I, first of all, I don't think we can prevent it because right. this is such an innate tendency, and especially in situations that are highly emotionally charged, like in a battlefield situation, I don't think we can stop soldiers from anthropomorphizing the robots. But the other reason that I no longer believe we should prevent it is because I've done a lot of reading on the use of animals in war, the history of that, and how... The same way animals were supposed to be tools on the battlefield, they were supposed to be helping and not putting people in danger, but obviously people became very emotionally attached to the animals they were working with. They would regularly risk their lives to save the animals. Very inefficient, very dangerous, but at the same time, the animals provided such a source of comfort to them through these really difficult situations. And that's part of the reason that we do this, that we create these strong emotional connections, even with non-living things like robots, is because we have this drive, and especially in these emotionally difficult situations, it may even be something that helps people survive. So I don't think it's as black and white as just we need to prevent this anymore. But it is something that we need to be extremely aware of and acknowledge that it's happening so that we can address it appropriately where possible.
How far off are we intuitive robots? So not quite totally sentient, but on the way there. Because people listening to this may well be thinking, well, okay, I'm just about to get my head around, you know, a bomb disposal unit that is working that way on wheels and what have you. I can probably think about some of the canine type robots that we see that are sort of strutting around, particularly over in the United States, you know, the Secret Service use. But ones that are almost using perhaps AI to become more sentient and then doing things. How far off is that, do you think?
I guess my question would be, how do you define sentient or intuitive? I mean, we have AI systems that are capable of reasoning now, mm-hmm. but I don't know that we have a clear definition of what sentient even means. What we do have and what we're close to having is robots and AI systems that can pretend to have human emotion and feelings and kind of trick us into thinking they're very smart. Mm-hmm. That's actually been happening for a while because we love to project this type of intelligence onto the machines. So I think my work has mostly been focused on trying to understand our projections, because in some ways that matters more than what the machines are actually capable of.
And there's this whole issue around trust that I'm sort of grappling with here at the moment. You know, it's if I look at a robot, and I'm sure other people out there as well, that you know, I'm one of those people that look at it and I see a machine. I don't have this sort of, some might say, fluffy feeling towards
you say that,
them.
But if you met my baby dinosaur robot, you might.
You wanted
your
to
mind.
Bring your baby dinosaur, and I wouldn't let you. So maybe there's
you
something
were afraid
in that.
Of,
I was afraid of it.
Of developing an emotional attachment.
I was. I wasn't going to let you take it home. That's what it was. but for me, I suppose where I'm going with this is a degree of trust that we begin to form with technology. So, you know, I'm using an iPad at the moment, for instance, which has got some notes on it. I trust the iPad to work. Now, maybe I shouldn't, but I do to a certain extent. Would I do that with a robot? I don't know. I'm not sure, you know. And so if we're putting robots into things like, I don't know, medical environments, care home environments, you know, these sorts of things, how do we, or do we need to develop a degree of trust, do you think? Do we need to train people to use the robots or train the robots to work with the people? Where do we sit on all of that?
I mean, we need all of that, right? And there's also, there's a lot of mistrust and also misconceptions around the technology just based on all of the science fiction and pop culture that we have in Western society, where we're sometimes overestimating or underestimating what robots are capable of. I do think one very interesting thing about trust when it comes to those robots that we in particular humanize or project life onto, it's both easy to generate trust if you have like a very cute robot that's responding in a way that you expect a living thing to, but it's also very easy to break that trust. And I right. think it's because we're anthropomorphizing these systems, you don't expect your iPad to be deceptive, but if your iPad, I don't know, looked like a little person and was like making certain mistakes, you might suddenly become mistrustful of it in a way that you wouldn't necessarily of just the iPad, because we have this social projection onto anthropomorphic machines. And so that's something that actually Brian Scassolotti at Yale has done a lot of work around, how we trust anthropomorphic technology, but also that trust can be broken very easily.
Right. I'm just sitting here thinking about that whole sort of trust thing, and I'm reminded of quite literally almost bumping into a robot in Amsterdam airport, because they were using the robot to collect plates and cups and all of that kind of thing in the restaurant. And this probably says more about me than it does about the robot. And so I saw this thing and I thought, I'm just going to stand in front of it to see what it does. So we had this sort of standoff with the robot not moving and doing anything, and me not moving and doing anything. And it was, you know, seeing who was going to blink first. But it just strikes me again that when we put them out into the wild, if you like, into that kind of environment, you're going to get people like me who are just doing that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
How do we sort of train both sides of that? How do we train the robot to identify somebody who's just being fairly bloody-minded about this? And how do you train people like me to, you know, get a bit of a life and just let the robot go on and do its thing?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's your responsibility. Like, I think that's something that we need to anticipate as we design technology, that of course people are going to screw around with it. I do that too, by the way. I stand in front of every robot that I meet just to see how it works. But, you know, I've worked with engineers for many, many years now, and I know that people building robots, a lot of them have worked for so many decades just to create technology that is functional and that is, you know, robust and safe and secure enough to even put in a space where it can interact with people, because robotics is very difficult. It's a very difficult challenge to create a machine that can even function in a space with people and not, you know, bump into you when you stand in front of it. But they have not, for the most part, worked on anticipating how people will behave around the robots. And so we've seen a number of failed deployments, or, you know, robots in shared spaces that people aren't very happy with, because what's missing is understanding that human-robot interaction element. And I think in order to have really effective technology integration, we need to understand in particular that social element and that emotional element, and that people do treat robots differently than other devices and do treat them kind of like living things. And there's actually an example. So there's a grocery store chain where I live, and they have a robot that roams the aisles. And a lot of people don't really like this robot. And we did a little, it wasn't a proper study. We wanted to do a proper study, but the pandemic hit and we couldn't.
Okay.
But we did do a quick like sentiment analysis on Twitter and kind of establishing that people don't like this robot. And then we did a survey of people, and a lot of people said they didn't like the robot because it was watching them. And so what the stores have done is the robot is not watching anyone. The robot is scanning the floors for like spills and tripping hazards. But they put some googly eyes on this robot, and the robot's very tall. It's like 6 feet tall, and it has these googly eyes. And so we wondered if people felt like it was watching them, even though the eyes are fake. So I think that there's a lot to explore in the space of how, you know, people respond to robots in shared spaces that could help engineers and designers design better technology. And again, I don't think it's on the user, the people who encounter the robots to need to be educated. I do think there's a lot we can do with design that would already help with that.
Mm. Talk to us a little bit about the sort of use cases. So how can robots support human workers, for instance, without necessarily replacing them completely? Because some people automatically get very concerned about, you know, is a robot going to take over and replace me in my job, particularly if they're in a, say, a manufacturing environment or logistics environment. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's one of my main concerns in how we talk and think about robotics and the type of robotics we're investing in currently, because I think this one-to-one replacement idea is very limiting. But I think it has a lot to do also with our political economy and culture and less to do with the technology itself, that we are chasing short-term profit incentives, trying to automate tasks in a way where we can reduce the labor force. And I don't think that should be the goal. I think it would be much better to invest in technology that helps people do a better job. And we do see a lot of that happening because it is the better the better way forward. You can massively increase production by helping people do better rather than just trying to automate people away to make a quick buck. That strategy we see happening and failing over and over again. So I think it's important that we're making the right choices. It's not that technology determines what happens. It really is us as a society choosing to set the right incentives for companies and invest in the right kinds of technology. And I do think that there's much more promise in that path, the path of trying to partner with these technologies and what we're trying to achieve rather than trying to replace people or recreate something we already have.
Mm. I want to go back to that example you gave of the robot with the googly eyes patrolling the aisles. What are the key factors that you see in terms of how we can better influence public acceptance of robots in everyday life? Because that seems to me to be quite a good use of a robot.
Yeah, I mean, it is a pretty good use. I do think that, well, the way that we design the technology matters, obviously, but also the way we frame it for people. So I think people often default to this idea of, oh, this robot is replacing a worker, or this robot is here to do something that a human should do. I think really moving away from that narrative and highlighting more that robots are supplementing human ability and trying to frame it differently for people is important. And one of my favorite analogies that I like to use instead of, you know, robots are like humans, is that we should think of them more like animals and okay. how we've partnered with animals, not because their skill sets are like ours, but because they're different from ours. And that's really useful to us. And so animals are these entities that can sense, think, make autonomous decisions and learn. And we've partnered with them for, you know, millennia to do work and even for social relationships. And so if we think about robots more like animals and we frame them that way for people, then maybe that can open people's minds up to other possibilities and challenge this constant narrative that the technology can, will, or should replace people.
Hmm. Let's sort of look at the long-term implications of some of this. So what do you see as being the potential impacts on emotional or social development from a human standpoint, I mean now, of more robots in society? Is it going to have an impact at all?
Oh, I think it is going to have an impact. I do think the impact depends a little bit on the choices that we make. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I do think, so looking at the history of how we've used animals, we've used most animals like tools and products, and some of them have been our companions. And my prediction for the future is that we're going to do the exact same thing with robots and AI, that most of them will be tools and products, and some of them will be companions. And when it comes to that aspect of companionship, I'm not concerned about the inherent nature of us developing social-emotional relationships with machines. I think that we're very relational creatures. Mm-hmm. I think that that tendency is something that has helped us survive in the past, and that it's not necessarily a bad thing for people to fold robots and AI into their social relationships the same way that we've, you know, made dogs part of the family, even right. though they used to have a function, like they used to have to guard the house, but now they're part of the family. But no one's saying, oh, that's replacing human relationships. However, the caveat to that is that companies make robots, and mm-hmm. there may be incentives given how our again, our current political economy is structured, to make robots that exploit a social emotional connection with a user, not for the user's own best interest, but in the interest of the company,
right,
and in the interest of making profit. And that, I think, is very undesirable as an outcome. And so if we can choose now to have strong consumer protection around these advanced chatbots and future social robots, I think we could safeguard against some of that and allow people to have these relationships. But if we don't do that, I'm a little bit concerned about what the future looks like.
Whose responsibility do you think it is to manage that interaction? If I look at regulation, typically it's always behind, right?
Oh, yeah.
But what you're talking about really, to my mind anyway, cries out for a little bit of thinking ahead from a regulation perspective to try to, you know, and if we look at the way that regulation around AI, regulation around the internet has been woefully inadequate until some would say it's too late. Do you think we're going to bump into the same challenge in this area, or do you think there's a little bit more hope that we might actually learn from the past?
I think it's not necessarily only a problem of needing to learn from the past, but it's also a problem of not having enough people in government who really understand the technology and see what's coming. So we certainly need more technical expertise and more interdisciplinarity in that way. I do think that, so just speaking from the United States perspective, mm-hmm, I know that there's been some movement around consumer protection for children and in the advertising space,
right,
because all of the older policies were based on kind of the TV era of television ads, yeah, and a bunch of research that was done around that. And so recently there's been a push to update that for the digital age and look at things like unboxing videos and Instagram influencers and all of these things. But I'm not sure that that's gone far enough yet. I think there's an extra step that policymakers need to take to look at these advanced chatbots and social robots and the potential for these kind of social agents to advertise to people. So we're not quite there, but I think, you know, we're doing the best we can as a society, as governments. I wish there were more resources put toward having a lot of technical expertise in government, but, you know, people who are at the forefront of technology are making, you know, $800,000 at Google, so it's hard to attract those people away from that, mm-hmm, even though it would be very honorable to go into government. So I do think we need more resources to address this.
Yeah, and I suppose only time will tell how it all pans out.
Yes.
Kate, it's been fascinating talking to you. Thank you so much for sharing some of those insights into robotics. I'm sure that listeners will have found that really interesting and probably are sitting there wondering about all of the different multi-uses that they might be able to be put to in the future. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Special thanks to this week's guest, Dr. Kate Darling. In the meantime, if you enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate and review the podcast, and we'd be pleased if you'd consider sharing the episode. To become a member, get in touch with Steve directly at steve.durbin@securityforum.org or on LinkedIn. Check out all our media and resources. All of it is there to support you at securityforum.org. Don't miss our other podcast, Dear InfoSec, sharing conversations with members about the real-world applications of ISF research. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox Productions and Tavia Gilbert. Thanks for listening.